Hi, I'm Joe Feeks, editor of Pig Health Today, and with me is Dr. Cameron Schmidt. He is a veterinarian for Pipestone Veterinary Services in Independence, Iowa. Cameron, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
At the 2017 American Association of Swine Veterinarians Conference, you gave a presentation on opportunistic pathogens. And they always seem to rear their ugly head, don't they?
Yep. There's lots of opportunity we give bugs in pork production systems, and then I usually am the guy on the other end of the phone call trying to either prevent them or stop them once they get going.
Let's talk about the respiratory ones first. I mean, which are the most common opportunistic pathogens that you're tackling these days?
Yeah, a lot of the portion of the respiratory disease section in my presentation. If we look at the data on prevalence of PERS and prevalence of swine influenza, probably around 50% of our weaned pigs today are weaned with a primary viral pathogen, which basically leads the door wide open for Haemophilus parasuis, Streptococcus suis, Mycoplasma, Pasteurella, a host of our pathogens are literally waiting at the point of weaning. We apply a little stress with a long, truck ride to a wean to finish site, and it's very common to right out the gate battle respiratory disease because of just the current state of affairs in the industry.
So knowing that potential, and it's kind of scary to hear about all those bugs, what should a producer do? I mean, obviously they need to get you involved, but what's the first step on their end?
Well, ultimately preventing or minimizing, eradicating PERS, whether it's filtration, whether it's different biosecurity tactics that a producer can take to prevent PERS, vaccination on flu, different prevention strategies. If you don't get rid of the primary insult, unfortunately today you end up in the antibiotic camp, whether that's a long-acting injectable, whether that's starting the pig out on feed meds, whether it's starting out on water meds, different flows and systems. One may be superior to the other because of how the system is structured.
Now you say unfortunately, I'm assuming you're talking about from a cost standpoint, it's another expense for the producer, mm-hmm. but these are clearly valuable tools that you have in fighting these infections.
Oh, definitely. I mean, unfortunately, I'd love to go antibiotic free, but today we aren't there yet as an industry. That's something that hopefully we'll catch up to the poultry world over time. We're getting better. With 209 and 213 starting to regulate, our antibiotics, our feed grade antibiotics, we're starting to walk down that pathway. We have, it's a long path, but over the next, I'm assuming, decade, we'll probably, get there.
And I want to come back to those FDA guidelines in a minute, but let's talk about the enteric side. Mm-hmm. There are also opportunistic pathogens there. What have you been seeing lately?
Very much so. PED gets all the press, but even in really healthy flows, we commonly fight rotavirus and E. coli and really a static pig intestine where he just gets weaned off of mom. He doesn't know how to eat feed. He gets thrown into a barn with, 1,200 or 2,400 of his best friends. It doesn't know any of them. And some of those pigs stall out. And because there's not calories there, they go into really a death spiral. And so getting early feed intake, getting gruel feed intake, getting calories into that pig so he can fight the infection on his own is a key piece of the equation.
How do you go about doing that?
I go through gruel feeding, creep feeding, so we can increase, a piglet, when he's nursing on mom, doesn't really know what pelleted feed is. No one tells him or writes a story for him and says, hey, when you go to this barn, make sure you eat the stuff in the bottom of the feeder. That's right. So we can do some programming in the farrowing crate right before he's weaned, so he at least understands that here's what feed is, and, get more pigs eating early on so they develop good gut health. There's also a lot of work in probiotics today. I can't say that we're there, But they're definitely direct-fed microbials that are being used in other industries. We see that coming down the pipe in the pork industry in a big way as well.
We read a lot today, both in human medicine and animal medicine, about the microbiome. Mm-hmm. And what does that really mean in terms of these young pigs?
Yeah, it's we're just now, with sequencing technology, being able to do basically enteric biome sequencing. So we can look at the pig's intestinal contents, and there's literally thousands of bacteria, viruses, you know, protozoa, et cetera, that we can at least start seeing the forest, right? We know there's a forest there, but we can't tell what kind of trees there are or plants or whatnot. We're just getting where the cost has come down to where we can look at that. And we can also look at resistance patterns for antibiotics within that biome as well. And how all that stacks up and how we metric that and how we define healthy and unhealthy, we're just scratching the surface today. So, like I said, we know there's a forest there. We're just starting to be able to see the tops of the trees, but we're getting there. Over the next 5-10 years, we're definitely going to have a lot better knowledge of just what's going on there, of modeling good flora, bad flora, and what trigger event caused the good flora to change to bad flora.
Let's talk about the new FDA guidelines, specifically the Veterinary Feed Directive. Now, that's not entirely new to the pork industry. You had at least one medication that required a VFD previously, but now you've got several, both enteric and respiratory antibiotics that require VFD. These are products that producers, that if they thought they needed them in the past, they could just use them for a week or two or whatever they thought was good. How do you see that changing our approach to disease management?
Well, you know, I'm not necessarily a big fan of regulations, but at this level, it really has forced everyone to take a look at what they're doing, right? It's put some base parameters around, hey, rather than running tetracycline, for example, the whole nursery period, we're going to run it for 2 weeks at a known dose, known quantity, and before we can use it again, you know, we need to take another look. So it ultimately, to this point, the changes that were made January 1st haven't been a negative impact. What we need to get to is actually metricing what we're using, knowing what resistance patterns are out there, and this is kind of forcing our hand to start looking deeper at it.
And there are some enteric antibiotics too, sure, that Tylosin, for example, that now requires a VFD. Mm-hmm. Would you expect to see other diseases emerge or reemerge as a result of this new approach to antibiotic management?
It's possible. You know, the industry has, you know, utilized antibiotics for growth promotion and in some situations as a crutch for poor management. This is going to force some systems to make improvements that they've not, you know, chosen to make because they've had that crutch there. I don't see a reemergence of dysentery, of atrophic rhinitis, of I think as an industry we've moved beyond that just with normal sanitation, with eradication techniques that have been fairly widespread across the U.S. I think it's going to force us to be better. Ultimately.
Now, you talked about growth promotion, and that was one of the concerns of the industry, not just resistance, but people are saying, hey, these producers are using these antibiotics to promote growth. But when you look at the labels on some of the antibiotics that still have these performance claims, it doesn't say promote growth. It says increase feed conversion, increase rate of gain, and so forth. What is it, do you think, about these antibiotics that makes these pigs grow faster? Is there something, is this getting back to this microbiome, you think?
Oh, ultimately you're controlling, you know, if we just look at how the chemistry of different antimicrobials work, you know, we're likely suppressing pathogens to where ultimately the pathogen can't take the calorie and the pig gets to take the calorie. That's ultimately how they've been working. So we're suppressing, you know, not only bad bugs, but even good bugs in some situations, from, you know, chewing on calories, and the pig gets the benefit of that calorie, right? We buy calories and we sell pork, ultimately, is what we do. Well, if I've got a substance or substrate that allows more calories to convert into pork, why wouldn't you use it that way? Now, whether that's right or wrong, ultimately is the decision of, you know, of the FDA, of many bodies, but that's what's going on is, you know, pork producers are thrifty, they look at data, and when it says, yeah, well, I get more calories converted into pork, and I'm buying calories at, you know, a certain dollar figure, if I can get more of those converted into pork, great. Well, now we're kind of taking a step back going, wait a minute, are these tools, should they be used that way?
Now, you mentioned E. coli before. Are you seeing more resistant E. coli in the field?
We definitely on the fluoroquinolones, Baytra, we have seen an increase in resistance over the last 4 or 5 years. Whereas some of our pathogens look very stable at our first looks of their resistant profiles, some of them are changing to different drugs that we have. And like I said, we're just getting to where we can start monitoring, tracking, and, you know, the science will catch up. There's a need, there's a void. The science will get there to, we're just early. We're in the first inning.
In the first inning, good way to put it. You also address septic bacterial infections mm-hmm. and lameness in pigs. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to me about that a little?
Yeah, once a pathogen can get to the bloodstream of the pig, it loves going to really immunologically protected areas, so the joints or the pericardium, around the brain, around the lungs, around the abdomen. Bugs pick, joints versus the other areas of the body, we don't fully understand the pathogenesis of that or the virulence factors that guide those. Getting drugs into joints can be very difficult because it's an immunologically protected area. And so often lameness, whether it's a mycoplasmal type lameness, a strep or parasuis, we know it got from tonsil to bloodstream to joint, but we don't know the how, and ultimately we want to stop that before it gets to the joint.
And how do you go about doing that? Is it a nutritional path, or what do you do?
Great question. I don't know. We know generally how to stop it, but we do see flows where it's much more highly prevalent. We see other flows where we rarely see lameness. But again, we have to do a lot of diagnostics and you put together different strategies to reduce it.
Pigs are complicated, aren't they?
They seem easy. There's only about 10 bugs and about 10 drugs, but we don't know how they all interact even today.
Lots of moving parts.
That's right.
We've been talking to Cameron Schmidt. He's a veterinarian for Pipestone Veterinary Services in Independence, Iowa. Cameron, thank you again for stopping by.
Thank you very much.